KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, how might the new ceasefire deal change politics in Israel? Then what happens when state insurance programs run out of money? Also, Michelle Steele looks forward to college football's championship and NFL playoffs. Then Andy Koren's rollicking new memoir on a mother of six whom he calls a Zoftic good time gal.
We played whack-a-mole with utilities. We burned bowling pins for warmth. It was hard. But what wasn't ultimately hard was that we were together.
His mother, Renee, and his memoir, Dirtbag Queen. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, January 18, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is to go into effect tomorrow. The head of the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon is casting the deal as a victory for the Palestinian people. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Naeem Qassem, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, spoke at a conference about Gaza. He said the ceasefire between Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, and Israel was a victory against Israel and America. He congratulated Palestinians on what he called their, quote, immense sacrifices and legendary steadfastness. The Gaza Health Ministry estimates at least 46,000 Palestinians have been killed in fighting between Israel and Hamas. Hezbollah itself was nearly decimated during a war against Israel starting in 2023. However, Qassem cast the decision to attack Israel and start a damaging 14-month war that left Hezbollah in tatters as a necessary effort from which Hezbollah, quote, emerged dignified with its head held high. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beirut.
President-elect Trump returns to Washington this weekend for celebrations in advance of his second inauguration. A planned victory rally tomorrow has been moved indoors because of cold temperatures. For the same reason, Trump will take the oath of office Monday inside the U.S. Capitol Rotunda instead of outside on the steps. Trump has promised to carry out mass deportations once he's president again. This is concerning employers in Nebraska, which has one of the worst labor shortages in the country. NPR's Jasmine Garz reports.
In Nebraska, for every 100 jobs, there are only 39 workers. In response, the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce has urged the state to be the most welcoming in the U.S. to foreign-born residents. Nebraskans overwhelmingly voted for President Donald Trump. When asked, most people NPR spoke to said they do not believe mass deportations will really happen. In the meatpacking towns, the mood is different. One worker, Richie, who asked that his last name be withheld for fear of employer retaliation, says,
Se escuchan resignados totalmente.
Immigrants out here feel they are going to get deported, he says, and they sound completely resigned to their fate. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Nebraska.
Firefighters in and around Los Angeles report they're gaining ground against several historic wildfires that have been burning since January 7th. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass says more residents are being allowed to return to their homes.
Yesterday and today, some evacuation orders will be lifted, and I want to thank our firefighters for that. Other zones are going to take longer. There's lots of hazardous waste.
At least 27 people were killed in the fires, which have destroyed more than 10,000 homes and other structures. This is NPR News in Washington. Pets from shelters in areas of Los Angeles County hit by fires will be getting a second chance in North Texas. Priscilla Rice of member station KERA reports.
The nonprofit Wings of Rescue and the Humane Society of North Texas are transporting 150 pets to Fort Worth this weekend. Senior Director of Social Awareness for Wings of Rescue, Cassie Davidson, says clearing out space at shelters in LA will allow wildfire evacuees and their pets to be reunited.
And so to alleviate that, to ensure that no animals are euthanized, to create kennel space, we are flying out as many pets as we can, as quickly as we can.
All of the pets arriving in North Texas will immediately go into foster homes. I'm Priscilla Rice in Dallas.
A gunman opened fire in the Iranian Supreme Court today, killing two judges before killing himself. The Iranian judiciary identified the judges as mid-ranking Shiite Muslim clerics involved in handling espionage and terrorism cases. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Activists had accused both judges of taking part in mass executions of dissidents in 1988. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is urging that people hospitalized with the flu also be tested for the bird flu within 24 hours of admission. A Louisiana man died of the bird flu earlier this month, the first known death in the U.S. Scientists say the bird flu remains a low risk for most people because so far it has not mutated to the point of human-to-human transmission. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and thank you for being with us. Israel's government has approved a ceasefire agreement with Hamas after 15 months of war. Ceasefire in Gaza is due to start Sunday morning. Under terms of the deal, Hamas is set to release 33 hostages in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. During the six-week pause, the agreement also calls for further negotiations to end the devastating conflict. Yossi Mecklenburg is a senior consulting fellow for the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a foreign policy think tank that's based in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And why do you think this agreement's been reached now?
That's I think, a key question, and probably the main factor is President-elect Trump. Because we all know that very similar, if not identical, agreement was on the table back in May. Mm-hmm. And we could have imagined how many lives could have been saved had it been agreed in May. And I think President-elect Trump made it very clear that he would like to see this done before the inauguration on the 20th. He sent his special envoy to speak to Netanyahu. And the pressure was on the Israeli government, also on Hamas, to agree. And he said it in uncertain words, otherwise hell will break loose.
Do you think they were seeking to, I don't want to say curry favor, but do a favor for President Trump?
I think curry favor is actually quite accurate. I think there is, you know, whether one loves or loathes President-elect Trump, there is a fear factor with him also because of his unpredictability. And definitely when it comes to Netanyahu, and in the balance of fear between his far-right elements in government that were against this deal all along, they are still against this deal. They would like to see the war continues. They have delusions of occupying Gaza and building settlements, and the fear of what might have been or might be the reaction from Trump. He decided the United States is too an important ally to Israel to start the term of a new president on the wrong foot.
Mm. What might the political consequences be for Prime Minister Netanyahu, do you think?
I think he tied himself in so many knots because of the current government that he leads, which is closely related and linked to his corruption trial. He formed the government with people that he knew that will cause him trouble all along, and it was not his choice, but other elements within the Israeli Knesset, and rightly so, said they won't share power with a defendant in a serious corruption trial. So he preferred his interest on the interest of the country and formed this government. But now they threaten to leave because they sense his weakness, A, because of his corruption trial, but also because he, at the end of the day, he is responsible as the leader of the country for what happened in October 7th, for Israel not being prepared for that, mm-hmm. and what has happened since then. So at a certain point, of course, not to take away from the terrible atrocity committed with Hamas, but Israel was not prepared for that. So he's vulnerable politically, and there are, and if you look at public opinion polls, A, most Israelis supported a deal like this for many months, mm-hmm. but because of the pressure inside the government, it didn't do. And also most Israelis would like election and would like to see those who are in opposition now leading the country.
Mr. Mecklenburg, do you think this means the war is actually over? Will the ceasefire hold?
I think it's too early to say. It's a very fragile truce. It's not even a ceasefire. It's a 6-week truce. And every step on the way, this truce is vulnerable. That's why it's and fragile. That's why it's so important that the United States and the rest of the international community, definitely those that mediated within the region, will follow every step of the way. Because it's, you know, if you look at the terms of this, the release of the hostages and the prisoners, every few days, few more hostages and more prisoners, letting Palestinians from Gaza to go back to the north of Gaza while trying to prevent certain elements to go back to the north. So this is every step of the way this can fall apart.
Is there a possibility for what used to be called a two-state solution, that Israel would accept a Palestinian state?
I think what we learned from what has happened in the last 15 months, this is the only solution that eventually can lead to a lasting and sustainable peace. And unless there is a two-state solution, I'm afraid we'll let this conflict to keep festering and we'll see more rounds of violence.
Yossi Mecklenburg from Chatham House, a London-based think tank. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
Damages caused by LA's wildfires may be the highest in U.S. history. Fires, floods, and storms in many parts of the country have been making insurance more expensive and harder to get for years, especially when insurers decide just to get out of risky markets altogether. More than 30 states have programs sometimes known as insurers of the last resort to keep insurance available, but what happens when they begin to run out of money? Doug Heller is Director of Insurance at the nonprofit Consumer Federation of America. He joins us now from Los Angeles. Mr. Heller, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Insurers of the last resort doesn't sound like a promising business plan. How does it work?
Well, these programs were developed initially in the 1960s, and they were supposed to be a kind of a support for the insurance system where there was a market failure, where the companies in the private sector just didn't feel able or didn't want to serve certain communities. But it was really meant to be a program just to sort out small problems in the market. What we've seen over the last several years here in California, but also around the country, are more and more insurance companies walking away from entire communities and leaving these insurers of last resort to grow and take on more and more risk. And it's really created a fragile system.
Well, what happens when, and this might be a situation coming to a head in California, there's just not enough money in that plan to pay out everyone?
Historically, the insurance companies themselves, the ones that didn't want to serve the customers, and so they were forced into that last resort market, the insurance companies themselves would backstop any extra losses to make sure that people did get their claims paid. We have some new rules in California that may allow the insurance companies to actually place an assessment on homeowners throughout the state. It could be that sometime later in the year, every Californian has a homeowner's insurance assessment on their premium in which they have to be the backstop rather than the insurance companies themselves. So that still has to play out, and the insurance companies are going to have to seek approval from the insurance commissioner. But of course, that's going to be a shock to people all around the state that they end up having to pick up the pieces for the last resort market, having lost too much.
Well, and let me pose a question I'm pretty sure will come up. Why should a homeowner in an area that's not likely to be hit by wildfires pay more to help people rebuild in an area that is?
Well, I think it's going to make people really quite angry, but I also think it's important to think about what insurance is supposed to be. Insurance is supposed to be a way to pool our risk. And what we need is a system where we don't bifurcate the market between the low risk who get to go to the private companies and the high risk who are stuck in these last resort plans. Insurance works better when it's a mix of some high risk and some moderate and some low risk. But when we have this system where the insurance companies are totally unwilling to serve communities that are higher risk, that concentration of high risk in the last resort plan becomes a burden that we all have to share.
I have to ask, I mean, can you imagine a company that would say, look, we're in the insurance business, not in the loss business, and these areas are overwhelmingly vulnerable?
Well, the insurance business is the loss business. The whole point of this is that we as homeowners, we'd never be able to rebuild our homes with the cash we have. Same with businesses and their properties. And so the insurance system is meant to be there to cover those losses. And we are supposed to pool our money together. But what's happened, I think, is the private sector insurers have decided that they really only want the most profitable, low-risk business. Now, that may make sense for their business, but it doesn't serve what the insurance system is supposed to do. And I think what we're seeing is that the private sector's approach to property insurance is starting to crack under the weight of the risk from climate change. And the public just can't fill those gaps under the existing structure.
Is it wise? Is it in the public interest for insurance programs to help people rebuild homes in areas that are now known to be more vulnerable to fires?
I think it's one of the most important questions we have to be asking ourselves these days. We do have to have that conversation, Scott, and we have to think about where we can and can't rebuild. But we have about 3 million American families in these last resort plans around the country, and we can't simply say to all of them, you're too high risk, you've got to move. That just won't work. So we have to plan for this rather than what we've unfortunately done, which is simply let the insurance companies walk away from the market and then force the public to pick it all up all at once. And so this is a time for not just reflection, but serious reconsideration of land use and housing all across the country.
Doug Hiller, Director of Insurance at the Nonprofit Consumer Federation of America, thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, thanks for having me.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Nora Rahm with these headlines. Aid organizations are gathering at the Egyptian border with Gaza in anticipation of a six-week ceasefire going into effect tomorrow. The agreement between Israel and Hamas would allow a surge in humanitarian aid to the more than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. Russian drones and missiles struck the Ukrainian capital Kyiv early this morning. Officials say at least 3 people were killed, at least a dozen more were wounded. And the popular video app TikTok says it will shut down in the U.S. tomorrow unless the Biden administration says it will not enforce a ban, which goes into effect then. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Monday marks 5 years since the U.S. recorded its first case of COVID-19. Well over a million Americans died over the next few years. The virus is still with us, of course, and there are new pandemic threats, including bird flu. NPR's Will Stone joins us. Will, thank you for being with us.
Sure thing, Scott.
You were in Seattle when that first COVID case, January 2020, in the U.S. was confirmed, weren't you?
I was. This was a man in his 30s who'd come back from Wuhan, China. And at the time, the message from public health was that the risk of human-to-human spread was low. It wasn't actually until the next month that it became clear the virus was spreading in the community here in Seattle and elsewhere in the country.
And 5 years later, how well prepared is the U.S. for another crisis like COVID?
It's a mixed picture. Certainly, there's a lot of disillusionment in public health and medicine. You'd hope that after a big pandemic, the country would be better off. But Dr. Andrew Pavia at the University of Utah told me it just doesn't look that way to him.
We've not done a really good job of changing the things that need to be changed. There's so much fatigue. There's so much trauma from the COVID pandemic.
The medical profession saw an exodus of nurses and doctors. The same trend is true in the public health workforce. Meanwhile, trust in public health and government agencies has fallen. Misinformation, fights over masking, school closures, lots of things could have played a role. And a recent survey from Harvard found trust in doctors and hospitals dipped from 70% in 2020 to less than 50% as of early 2024.
And what could some of the consequences of that be?
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the implications, Scott. I spoke to Lauren Sauer about this. She's an expert on pandemic preparedness at the University of Nebraska Medical Center.
People have to participate in public health, right? The public is the most important part. Unless we really spend a lot of time building the trust in public health back, we could build all the systems in the world and they won't work.
And along with that, funding is under threat. There was an infusion of money during COVID, but there have been proposals from House Republicans to slash funding for public health programs, including the CDC. And it's possible that it will gain momentum when President-elect Trump is sworn in on Monday.
Well, are there some notes of hope when it comes to pandemic preparedness?
Yes, there are some advances. Our ability to do wastewater surveillance to track the spread of disease. That's one example brought up by Caitlin Rivers. She's at Johns Hopkins and recently authored a book on fighting outbreaks called Crisis Averted.
Technology really stands out as a realm where we've seen some great successes. I think there's a lot of emphasis right now on diagnostic testing and also around vaccination. The mRNA platform has been very successful, gives us a new tool to develop vaccines quickly for the next pandemic pathogen.
And public health experts say having vaccines ready to go will be key for bird flu. That's why the government is stockpiling existing vaccines and developing new mRNA shots in case the outbreak escalates.
And what has the incoming administration said about bird flu?
Well, it's largely been silent. Certainly, Trump has the experience of Operation Warp Speed that produced the COVID vaccine. But scientists like Andrew Pavia at the University of Utah are concerned based on the track record of some of Trump's health picks. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. could lead the Department of Health and Human Services. For years, Kennedy led an advocacy group that's a big player in the anti-vaccine movement. And Scott, yesterday we learned that in the spring of 2021, Kennedy filed a citizen's petition on behalf of that advocacy group to the FDA. And in it, he requested the agency revoke the authorizations for the COVID vaccine for all demographic groups. Of course, the FDA denied this request, but Kennedy has an extensive history of making inaccurate and misleading statements on vaccines. And he has already made comments undermining trust in the existing bird flu vaccines. We reached out to the transition team for comment about their plans, but did not hear back.
NPR health correspondent Will Stone, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Russia's full-scale invasion in Ukraine, the war between Israel and Hamas, the civil war in Sudan. All of these conflicts have allegations of atrocities, and under U.S. law, the U.S. Justice Department has the authority to investigate and prosecute war crimes. With the Biden administration coming to an end, NPR's justice correspondent Ryan Lucas looks at what the department has and has not done to hold perpetrators accountable.
Congress passed the U.S. War Crimes Act in 1996. It gives the Justice Department jurisdiction to prosecute violations of the laws of war in American courts. It sat unused for nearly three decades until Attorney General Merrick Garland made this announcement in December 2023.
As the world has witnessed the horrors of Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine, so has the United States Department of Justice. That is why the Justice Department has filed the first ever charges under the U.S. War Crimes Statute against four Russia-affiliated military personnel for heinous crimes against an American citizen.
The Russian soldiers allegedly abducted and tortured an American civilian in Ukraine. The department announced a second war crimes case just last month against two former Syrian intelligence officers for allegedly conspiring to torture detainees, including U.S. citizens held by the regime of former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
I'm very pleased that we finally had prosecutions under the War Crimes Act, which has been on the books for some 27 years and really hadn't been used.
Stephen Rapp is a former U.S. ambassador at large for global criminal justice.
And very pleased to see that it applied not just in the Ukraine context, but also in the Syrian one, and I hope in others.
Those prosecutions have made headlines, but the department's efforts extend beyond that, says Eli Rosenbaum, a former federal prosecutor who spent much of his career hunting down Nazis long after World War II.
Under Attorney General Garland, there has been a concerted effort to pursue justice in the wake of human rights violations, atrocity crimes, war crimes, at a level I think never before seen in the department.
One example of that is a special unit set up by Garland and led by Rosenbaum until his retirement that investigates alleged Russian atrocities. Rosenbaum also points to the support the department has given to Ukrainian authorities to help them in their own war crimes investigations and to Garland's appointing a special prosecutor for the crime of aggression. War crimes are notoriously difficult to investigate and prosecute, in part because access to evidence and witnesses can be challenging. In a statement, a Justice Department spokesperson said war crimes cases are incredibly complex to bring, but said they are important to ensure accountability for these horrendous crimes. Ona Hathaway, a professor of international law at Yale Law School, says the department has taken steps in the right direction, but not enough.
They said all the right things. They made some of the right moves. But then it's been a little bit surprising that there's been so little to actually come out of it.
She says there was a lot of hope that the department would do more, given the current armed conflicts in the world. She points to the civil war in Sudan, where the Biden administration recently declared a paramilitary group has committed genocide. She also points to the conflict in Gaza. Hamas killed some 1,200 people in its October 7th attack on Israel and took more than 200 hostages. Israel responded with a military assault that has killed more than 46,000 people, according to Gaza's health ministry. Hathaway says the department has come under criticism for its failure to investigate possible war crimes by both sides in the conflict.
I think some of that is warranted, that there's a responsibility to actually investigate and to look at whether those cases ought to be brought forward.
UN rights officials have accused Israel and Hamas of possible war crimes, and the International Criminal Court prosecutor has requested warrants for leaders on both sides of the conflict. Israel says its actions have been lawful. For its part, the Justice Department has brought terrorism charges against six Hamas leaders, but the department has done nothing, in public at least, to investigate or prosecute possible Israeli war crimes, as the White House has maintained its firm support for Israel's war effort. The department's lack of action on the Gaza conflict has not gone unnoticed.
I think it's
really disappointing, let's put it that way.
Leila Sadat is a professor of international criminal law at Washington University in St. Louis.
I think it detracts from the global standing of the United States when the United States tries to argue that what it's doing is enforcing international law. Because immediately you'll get a pushback saying, well, why are you enforcing international law in some situations, but not in other situations?
In other words, it opens the U.S. to accusations of not being even-handed. At the same time, though, Sadat says the cases the U.S. has brought are important. And just because victims of alleged war crimes in Gaza aren't receiving justice doesn't mean that victims of Assad's regime in Syria or Russia's war in Ukraine shouldn't either. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
In the age of laptop computers, thumbing text messages, and AI chatbots, manual typewriters may seem antique. But for some of us, typewriters are as classic as B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music. And as Craig LaMolt of member station GBH reports, those selling and servicing typewriters say business hasn't been this good in decades.
Hi there.
Hello.
How you doing?
Tom Furrier greets a customer walking in the door of the Cambridge Typewriter Company, a tiny shop crammed wall-to-wall with old typewriters. The customer, Ron Lewis, has brought in a small portable typewriter he bought on eBay. Furrier opens its case.
Oh, it's a cute little thing. Look at that.
So the carriage gets stuck.
Yep.
And the bell doesn't work.
Yeah, it certainly does get stuck.
Lewis traveled 2 hours to ask Furrier to fix his machine. He got here just in time. He hadn't heard the news yet that the shop is closing at the end of March.
So retiring completely, closing the shop down?
Well, I can't find anyone to buy the shop.
Furrier has been at Cambridge Typewriter for 45 years. It all started when his friend, whose father owned the store then, asked if he wanted to try out fixing typewriters.
I came in and worked the entire day. It flew by in minutes, it seemed like. At the end of the day, this voice in my head said, this is it.
Furrier refurbishes old machines in a room in the back of his small shop.
I'm going to turn this on.
He uses an air compressor to blow out the dust and gunk in the keys of a 1950s Royal Quiet Deluxe. When he first started working here, Furrier says, there were about 40 busy typewriter shops across Metro Boston selling and fixing business machines. But then, of course, came the personal computer.
I remember how quickly it happened and being so shocked that the transition, which I thought was going to take years, happened almost overnight.
Everywhere, typewriter shops were closing. And as the owner of Cambridge Typewriter considered calling it quits, Furrier made the seemingly crazy decision to buy the shop in 1990. By then, there were almost no customers.
Sometimes I'd go like 3 or 4 months or 6 months without getting paid.
He says his wife supported him through the tough times, financially and emotionally.
Whenever I come home and I had a bad day, I come home and my shoulders are slumping and my head's down. And she goes, shoulders up there, soldier.
It was like that for years. But around 2001, he noticed something new. A high school-aged girl came in the shop looking for an old manual typewriter. Then, over a month or so, a few more did.
I finally asked one of the girls, I said, you know, what's up with, you know, the old Remington typewriters? And she goes, well, that's the typewriter Sylvia Plath used to write her poetry on. And ding, 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 the light went on over my head. And it's like, oh, my God, this is going to be the new thing. You know, young people looking for vintage typewriters to write their stories, their poetry.
Sure enough, business started picking up and hasn't slowed down since. By now, he was the only typewriter shop around. Things got even busier during the pandemic, with people stuck at home wanting to write.
I had a line of people waiting outside my store.
The resurgence of typewriters has continued. Shops have opened in recent years in Chicago, Dayton, and Merrimack, New Hampshire. There's an annual typewriter festival in Milwaukee, which claims to be the birthplace of the typewriter. Furrier says business is better now than ever before. But he's about to turn 70, and he's ready to retire.
It is very bittersweet. I am going to miss my customers so much. I get emotional just thinking about it.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I have a 10-year-old who's an old soul, and he wants a typewriter.
Hear it all the time.
We got him a laptop for Christmas, and he said, I was hoping for a typewriter.
For Steve Woelfel's son and others growing up surrounded by far more advanced technology, maybe typewriters will offer an antidote to AI. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Boston.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Hurricane Helene severely damaged western North Carolina's national forests, including a lot of old-growth trees that are over 100 years old. Conservationists had hoped those trees would get protection from the Biden administration under a proposal to try to better manage the forest to withstand climate change. But those hopes were dashed earlier this month when the Forest Service abandoned the idea. Katie Myers of GRIST and Blue Ridge Public Radio reports.
Josh Kelly walks softly on the bare winter ground in the Pisgah National Forest near Barnardsville, North Carolina. This is an old-growth forest, but he says it's not only the trees that matter.
Places like this that have never been logged is you have this soil profile that is just rich in nutrients and rich in history.
Kelly is a biologist who monitors logging for the advocacy group Mountain True. This is a cove forest because it's between mountain ridges and rugged, so it's been left alone from logging. That means some trees here are hundreds of years old.
Cove forests tend to be a real mix of ages. So while we have some of these big old trees, we've got middle-aged trees, we've got loads of these tiny saplings around.
But it's still considered an old-growth forest, and they've been suffering from a changing climate, says Will Harlan. He is the Southeast Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental advocacy group.
Climate change has been impacting the forests in a couple ways, but the main two are with droughts and floods.
The most recent floods here came with Hurricane Helene in September. It blew down an estimated 187,000 acres of forest in western North Carolina. In 2022, the Biden administration issued an executive order to protect old-growth forests on public land from the effects of climate change. The Forest Service then got to work on what's become known as the National Old Growth Amendment. Harlan says he had high hopes for it.
One thing about the Old Growth Amendment is it really emphasized the pressure that these forests are under because of climate change.
2.5 years later, after a lot of research and public input, the amendment was shelved. It would have set policy for all national forests on how to manage old growth in light of changing weather patterns. In an email, Forest Service officials did not give a reason for their action, but said they hoped their findings could still be helpful. John Hatcher of the North Carolina State Forestry Association was glad the amendment is on hold. He says it was confusing and didn't allow enough logging around older trees.
When you look at the U.S. Forest Service having over 200 definitions for old growth, it makes it really hard to have something like a universal framework that can be used across the Forest Service's footprint.
It's true old growth means different things in different regions. Most of the old growth east of the Mississippi is in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Out west, old growth is much older. Hatcher says there needs to be room on Forest Service land for recreation and logging.
You can still manage it in a sustainable way that strikes that balance and allows all those other uses while at the same time maintaining a healthy landscape.
But with a changing climate, that's hard to do, says Kelly. If you log too many young trees, it weakens the older ones in extreme weather.
Resilience to storms and blowdowns often depends on the forest around them. So the more of a forest that you have surrounding these bigger, older trees, the more buffered they are from winds and storms.
Without federal protection from climate change, the fight to save this old-growth forest will now go local. Kelly and Harlan say they are already gearing up to protect the Pisgah Forest from a logging project. For NPR News, I'm Katie Myers in Barnardsville, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
They used to be collaborators.
but a few diss tracks changed things fast between superstars Drake and Kendrick Lamar.
They not like us. They not like
us. Drake has filed a new lawsuit, not against Lamar for his lyrical attacks, but against his own record label for publishing and promoting that song. We'll tell you more Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Israeli government has approved a ceasefire agreement to end the fighting in Gaza after 15 months of war. This clears the way for Hamas to release some hostages tomorrow. More evacuation orders are being lifted in Los Angeles County as firefighters are making progress against historic fires. They burned more than 10,000 structures since they began January 7th. And in one of her last acts as Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen says her department will begin taking extraordinary measures Tuesday as the nation nears its debt limit. She again urged Congress to raise the debt limit to avoid a government default. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Celebrations continue in Syria since the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime in early December. But those public expressions of joy are tempered these days as Syrians begin to grapple with the reality of soaring prices and scarcities. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports from Damascus.
This busy traffic circle in Damascus has become a central gathering place to celebrate the new Syria. Friday after midday prayers, crowds line its sidewalks and small parks playing drums and bagpipes, singing revolutionary songs. It's hard to express how happy we are, beams 28-year-old Hala Sorur. She's painting small Syrian flags on kids' faces. Let the children be happy, she says. We all spent so many years suppressed. She finishes her flag with three red stars and a splash of silver glitter. No charge, she says. On the sidewalk, vendors hawk everything from bottled water to baby wipes and candies. Since the regime fell, previously restricted goods are flooding into Syria. Exorbitant tariffs and dollar controls have been lifted, and vendors are free now to sell on the streets. Khalid Salih says in the early days of the fall of Assad, he was selling out of Syrian flags in all shapes and sizes. But he says sales have dropped along with celebrations. People are now so busy with working and trying to feed themselves, he says. Once in the thousands in the weeks following the regime's fall, only about 100 are in the circle this day. But fighter Muhammad Abu Taha, dressed in fatigues with his assault rifle slung over his shoulder, isn't deterred. Look at the fabric of our society now, everyone all together, he says. He's with the interim Islamist government. He says he knows people are in need, but in about a year or two, with the help of the wealthy Gulf state Qatar, the government will turn the economy around. It's unclear how long Syrians can wait, though. Many in the circle came to protest, something unthinkable during the regime. One group decries low government salaries, another demands information about loved ones who vanished in Assad's brutal prisons. But others want to keep celebrating. Like this boy waving a flag atop his parents' car and singing, cursing the Assad family. It's one of the most popular songs in Syria today. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Damascus.
And now it's time for sports. NFL playoffs underway. College football's championship finally. And a baseball legend with a 200 career batting average, Michelle Steele of ESPN, joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Sounds like a jam-packed sports segment.
Well, it is, stuff. Thanks to you, my friend. The NFL divisional playoffs begin today. But the main dish, you know, tomorrow night. Buffalo Bills host the Baltimore Ravens. Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Derrick Henry. Who can stop them? Maybe the weather. A lot of snow in the forecast, right? What does this mean?
Yeah, you know, I think for the fans, it'll be great. I love football in a snow globe. We've established this on this show.
Yeah.
And playoff football in a snow globe is going to be even better. I'm sure that the Bills are going to try to leverage this against the Ravens, but Lamar Jackson's actually really good in cold weather. When it dips below freezing, he's 3-1. But the excitement around this game is around the stars, just like what you said. It's not the weather. It's Lamar Jackson. It's Josh Allen. These are two front runners for MVP.
Yeah.
Jackson's playing so well. Buffalo has improved so much since they got dominated by Baltimore week four. They lost 35-10. I think they're going to manage to score more than 10 points in this game. The big sticking point for me is I just don't think, Scott, that the Bills are going to be able to stop the run game. Derrick Henry, Lamar Jackson. Yeah, I think they're going to have a hard time because they don't have, how do I put this, big enough humans on the other side to stop them. We'll see what happens. Bills team, prove me wrong, but we'll see.
I'd like to see Buffalo get a little good luck.
A lot of people would. Yeah, I think it'll be a good game.
Okay, yeah, certainly. College football national championships Monday in Atlanta, Ohio State and Notre Dame, two historic programs. Let me just say, shut down the thunder from the sky. But she looks stronger.
The Buckeyes, they are the definite favorites in this matchup. They've got the number one defense, Scott. Their offense has absolutely turned heads as well this postseason. They've got this receiver, Jeremiah Smith. He has been uncoverable in the playoffs. And Notre Dame just doesn't have the kind of offense that's going to be able to overcome a big point deficit. That being said, I was talking to a college football insider recently. He compared the Irish defense to an ankylosaurus dinosaur. And just to paint a picture for you, it looks like a turtle with a big, intimidating weaponry on its tail, low to the ground, armored, indestructible. So don't count Notre Dame out here.
I never do. What a scholarly approach, by the way. And and finally, Bob Uecker, journeyman ball player with four teams, 200 career hitter, catcher, couldn't catch a knuckleball, but he became a beloved baseball wit, a movie star. An announcer for his hometown Milwaukee Brewers, died Thursday. He was 90. Here he is when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame as an announcer in 2003.
I still, and this is not sour grapes by any means, still think I should have gone in as a player.
How will you remember Bob Uecker?
You know, I was never lucky enough to work with him or meet him, but the most resonant thing I think said about Bob Uecker this week was said by Adam Sandler, who said it was like losing your dad's best friend.
Yeah.
A parent's best friend who dies, someone they're always welcome in your home.
Yeah.
They're always around. They've been around as long as you have, but they're not going to be there anymore. And For Brewers fans, he was the sound of summer, and I get that. You know, for me, Harry Carey was the sound of summer for a long time. So I remember him for being the funny TV dad from Mr. Belvedere, and of course, the iconic, I know you did this with Elving not too long ago, but just a bit outside, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Ah, he was terrific. It was, so glad to benefit from his life and work. Michelle Steele of ESPN, thanks so much for being back with us. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
December 15, 2021, an obituary appeared in the Fayetteville, North Carolina Observer.
A plus-sized Jewish lady redneck died in El Paso on Saturday. Because she was my mother, the death of Zaftig, good-time gal Renee Corin, at the impossible old age of 84, is newsworthy to me, and I treat it with the same respect and reverence she had for, well, nothing. A more disrespectful, trash-reading, talking, and watching woman in North Carolina, Florida, or Texas was not to be found.
Ah, nothing like a son's love, is there? Andy Corin, the performer and playwright, has written a memoir of his mother so colorful and pungent. I don't think we can ask him to read as much as a paragraph on the air. His book, Dirtbag Queen. And Andy Corin joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's such a thrill to be with you, Scott. From one son of a showgirl to another son of a showgirl, we really grew up cared for and loved by the best ladies in the biz.
I absolutely agree with that. You refer to you and your siblings as, I'm going to quote you again, Renee's little tribe of nose-picking, to the quick, nail-biting, chain-stealing, dirty-minded, no good, and I'm dropping a few words. How so? What kind of kids were you?
We were her kids. We were, as many children in this country are, raised in our parents' image. She was both mother and father for us. We were taught to ask wrong questions only, shoot first, ask after, and to raise ourselves, because her version of mothering certainly didn't fit any conventional sense or word of mothering that we have come to appreciate and understand. Her version of mothering was, put on a helmet. It's tough out there.
Yeah. What brought Renee and hence your family to Fayetteville, North Carolina? Because she told you she thought she would never end up there.
I used to beg her, can we please move to Durham? I would just beg her every day.
Glad we could oblige you today, at least, yes.
Please, can we just move to Durham? No, we ended up in Fayetteville like most people. Our car broke down. Just kidding. It was the Army. Most people end up in Fayetteville for one of three reasons. They just got out of jail, they just got out of the Army, or their car broke down on the 95.
Did you feel at home there?
This book, for me, the end result has been I've really healed my relationship with who I truly was in Fayetteville, which was a happy, relatively speaking, well-adjusted, talented, vivacious, vibrant, young, gay kid. And while growing up the way we grew up was chaotic, it was my town. It was my people. And I'm so proud to be from Fayetteville, just as proud as I am to have, of course, left it.
Could you tell us about the days you helped your mother at a local bowling alley?
Yes. We were raised by a woman who frequently worked three shifts. Some of those were legal jobs. Some of them were not as above board. But B&B Lanes was the center of our life. And B&B Lanes was an incredibly fun, almost like a community center. And it was really like an island of misfits.
She saw to it that you and your brothers and sisters were well fed there, didn't she?
We could really count on getting at least one hot square meal, a hot and a cot at the B&B Lanes, because we could always get the keys to the snack machines, a burger off of the snack bar, or a nap in the nursery. And so we loved going to B&B Lanes, you know, as kids, of course. Who doesn't love being able to run free in the arcade? But because our mother ran the place and then more or less ran an after-hours casino at the place, we were like, you know, the crime boss's kids. We were respected and feared.
We ought to add, Renee, your mother was a voracious reader, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She was an indiscriminate and fast reader, I might add. I'm a good reader because of her, but I never mastered how fast she could read a book. A day, and it was gone. We grew up really sharing story as our first primal love language.
And she had gorgeous hands, didn't she?
The hallmark of surviving her existence was a little vanity goes a long way when you're a blue-collar worker. And so regular scheduled hair dyeing sessions and weekly manicures. Even at the very end, when she lay passing in an El Paso hospital, she went in with manicured peach nails, and that's how she left this world.
I know what you mean. When my mother was in her last days, one of the errands I had to run for her was to tell her manicurist she wouldn't be in because she was going to die.
The most important thing for her was getting Elva, who she used to go to weekly in her garage in El Paso, to come to the El Paso hospital and fix her hair.
Could I get you to tell me about the nights you and your mother and siblings would spend in an area of town called Hay?
Yes, Hay Street, as most people who came through and around Fayetteville throughout the 1960s, 70s, and early 80s before it was demolished, was one of the most legendary red light districts in all of the world. Bars, billiard halls, strip clubs, fights, bikers, soldiers, farm boys, hogs, pickup trucks, and we delivered the papers there between 3 and 6 a.m. or so. Hay Street has been long gone. It's been gone for over 40 years. But up until they really demolished the 500 block of Hay Street, it really stood as an example for my mother that at least we had this going on in Fayetteville.
I'm touched by the scene of how you and your mother and family would end the night in the pre-dawn hours at the Shoney's Buffet. I mean,
that's right.
That's almost like the Waltons.
I never wanted to leave the impression that my mother didn't love us or care for us or try her darndest to keep us together and keep a roof over our heads. Those roofs were leaky. Those houses were shaky. Many of them were filled with bugs. We played whack-a-mole with utilities. We burned bowling pins for warmth. It was hard. But what wasn't ultimately hard was that we were together. And delivering those papers, that's our third shift. We would end up at a Shoney's Buffet and relive the whole night together. It was an exquisite and tender way to care for her kids in the only way that she could.
And I do have to ask you, is your childhood more fun in the retelling than it was at the time?
The truth is, and you know this, son of Ernie, son of Pat, you know that when you're raised by a comedian, you take the sweet and you take the bitter, right? So we laughed. We laughed while it all burned down around us. She just couldn't help but laugh at all the troubles, many that she caused on her own, but that wash ashore of a big, broke, single mother of six in the South in the 70s and 80s. So was it hard? Of course it was hard. Many of my brothers have what I think is an appropriate trauma response. They've completely forgotten most of their childhood. But I didn't. I took notes, and it was fun sometimes.
I'm so glad you did. Andy Corin's book, Dirtbag Queen, A Memory of My Mother. Thank you so much for being with us.
It is such a thrill to talk to you and to be on NPR. Thank you so much, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From American Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.